The number one thing that stood out for me is that you have to really audit your capabilities. So really think about what makes you good at the things that you do, because there's a level of skill and competency that sits underneath your products and services that could be packaged and monetized in a different way. Like if you're a keynote speaker, let's say keynote speaking was really at risk of becoming irrelevant. How can you look at the skills that you have underneath that to help other people? It could be in communication, it could be in structuring, like even the work that I've done, a bit of AI proficiency, running things like Think Week, podcast setups. You know, like we have all these capabilities that live under the things that we do, and all of those things actually have the potential to be monetized. That's a great little exercise to go through for you if you feel a bit threatened by where the future is going, is to not just think about yourself in terms of the craft, like I'm a copywriter or I'm a designer, but break it down into what are the skills that live beneath that. A step down from that is that actually what you realize is that you are good at things like learning and curiosity. But even those like sort of meta skills, they require the space. Like if you aren't focusing on optimizing those and creating the space for them to flourish where you can go and try out new things and learn new things, then of course, you know, like your path through relevance becomes a lot more linear. And one of the final things I'll just say on this is that the Shigetaka Komori walked into the boardroom and he wrote one word on a whiteboard, and that word was Shinrai, and it stood for trust. When we operate in a world where there's a lot of uncertainty, the only trust you can really have is in yourself. And if you don't trust yourself to reinvent and that you can figure it out, then I think that's, you know, that's going to be your biggest downfall.
Hello, 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 and welcome to this week's Expansive Podcast. Wonderful for you to be joining us again. We, Eric and I have been on the call for the last hour or so, prepping and getting ready for the year ahead as far as what Expansive has got in store for us and for you as our listeners. And so thank you for joining us again. We've got some really exciting things coming up. And before we get into this week's Expansive pod, it's always good to check in with my co-pilot and pretend like we haven't been speaking for the last hour. Eric, how's it? How are you? What's happening, Eric? Which is so funny, you know, every time I see a talk show or like anything, they like greet each other like they haven't been prepping and speaking to each other. Like the audience is sitting there like, guys, you've been prepping for 3 weeks. So now you're coming to greet each other on stage. Anyway, hello, Eric. How are you? What a surprise to see you here. You come here often.
It's so amazing. Yeah, it's great to be talking to you for the first time today and to be catching up on our lives and to not be rehashing what we've already said to each other for the past hour.
Exactly. It's all show. It's a whole smoke and mirror show. Yeah, exactly.
This is the world that we live in. It's the show business world.
Yes.
Exactly. Yeah, listen, I mean, we are recording today, 30th of Jan. Can you believe January is done? Like first month of 2026.
Well, it took 3 years. Are you talking? Well, I mean, you've seen all the memes. True. Jan's been the longest year. So many memes out there about January.
I've actually really enjoyed Jan. It's felt like a good month. It's been I've definitely felt momentum building in the month. And it has felt long, to be honest. But I'm happy that we are here. It's been good. This also means that we are 33% of the way through quarter one already. So time is flying. And it's our third pod for the year. So we've done 3 out of the 4 weeks. So that's pretty good.
Yeah.
But otherwise, good, man. Sure. Lots on the go, working on talks, refining talks, writing new talks. Been running all these jumps on January sessions. So yeah, good in the thick of it. You know what? The thing I'm actually been enjoying the most is, and it's going to sound weird, is I feel like my brain is just switched on at the moment. And the reason I'm saying that is there was a patch end of last year where I almost felt like my brain wasn't clicking. And it wasn't just fatigue. It was my use of AI. You know, like everyone was saying last year that if you overuse AI to help you or do your thinking for you, then it's going to slow your brain down. And I actually really started to experience that at some point where I would think about things that I wanted to write or post or do, but like I couldn't get to think about it. And I realized it was because I was just outsourcing that to AI the entire time. And I've made a very conscious effort to spend more time writing on my own, thinking on my own, and then going to AI to augment that. And I think because I've changed my workflow slightly, like I'm just feeling like on. I'm feeling good and sharp, and it's weird, but that's where I'm at. Where are you at? What's happening?
Look, I think it's also seasonal, man. No, I also think it's seasonal. I think we all go through those periods of you feel like a dunce, you know, you feel like you can't bring out any creativity. You got nothing new coming out of you. You're feeling a bit frustrated and stuck. And then other times, I think it's just flowing. I mean, you got so much coming through you, creative. And, you know, we were laughing off air because Eric has had a very good financial month in January. That's why it's been great, listeners, just to let you know. So, and we were laughing because Eric goes through this. And so do we. I mean, all of us go through this, you know. I remember in my restaurant days, on a Thursday, Friday, and Saturday, I was a hero. On Monday and Tuesday, I thought my restaurants are closing because nobody was there, right? So we were so sensitive to like daily turnovers. Like, oh my God, I've had three bad Mondays in a row. This is terrible. My restaurant must be suffering. And it's the same, you know, whatever business you're in, your mood, unfortunately, is linked to the amount of turnover you're doing and sales inquiries that you have and success. And success, I mean, how shallow is that? But it's what it is. It's the weirdest thing, you know? It's like, it's a confirmation from the outside world towards how we add value, right? And I was building a new talk this morning and I was talking about the difference between the sort of suffering mind and non-suffering mind. And the suffering mind is continuously looking for external validation. And the non-suffering mind is totally focused on internal. And it's funny because I think you and I both experienced this, that in the meditation, in the process, we're very internal. We're very focused on that. There's nothing from the exterior because, I mean, the outside has disappeared. As Dr. Joe always says, is become nothing and you become nothing. But the minute we come out of meditation, we're like, okay, well, let me check my mails. Okay, are there any inquiries? Okay, did we close anything? You're like, oh my God, you went straight back into that mind of a sufferer while you just spent an hour being a mind of a non-sufferer. It's like, what the hell's wrong with us? I mean, I made this post a month ago and I was like, there's something seriously wrong with us. I walk a lot, obviously, and I see people on their phones. And I think to myself, what a bunch of idiots. Look at them walking on their phones. Well, I mean, walking and being on their phones. And then next thing, I get onto my phone and I'm walking with my phone and I'm doing exactly what they did. And the minute I get off my phone, I'm like, look at these idiots missing out on what's going on around the world. You know, it's like, there's something wrong with us. Sir. There's really That's something so funny. Really seriously psychologically issues. Yeah. With us, you know, it's comedic. It's comedic.
You know, what's so funny is that I do my Joe meditation, Joe Dispenza meditation in the morning. And then very often we'll get into the car, you know, Dan and I to go somewhere and the Bluetooth kicks in and it just grabs the meditation as like the first thing to start playing. And Dan is like, what is this crap? Because like all of a sudden you just hear, you know, Joe with all like these weird intonations.
Shouting at you.
What were you listening to? It's so weird when you're not in that
space. Witchcraft.
To be listening
to you're doing
witchcraft.
All these things that are happening inside there.
Listen, but so how are things on your side? Doing well? How's the book?
Yes, very good. Very good. Thank you. You know, we've got the dried fruit business that's kicking off. All the samples are arriving. If the listeners don't know, I've started a business called Velvet Harvest and it's the world's best dried fruit, quite literally, because South Africa is the world's best dried fruit. And so I met my suppliers today, this week at the Gulf Food Show. The Gulf Food Show is the biggest food show in the world. So I was there. It was amazing. It was really nice meeting them and just seeing what everybody else is up to and what else everybody else is doing. Just really interesting because, you know, building products, building brands, distributing them in the right way, dripping them down from luxurious to less luxurious to mainstream. Just that whole process. I love that process, you know, building it and building it out. I just absolutely love it. I've been doing it since I was a kid. So like, it's just quite natural for me to think about. And so we're building this very high-end dried fruit brand, which actually isn't anywhere in the world. I spoke to a few people that have been in the business for many years and they're like, they've never seen anything like it. They've never seen such a premium dried fruit option. So that's really exciting for me because that's coming to fruition. Next week, we should have all the samples and all the boxes. So we start to see all our partners and distributors and start getting it into the market. So look out for that. Social media will kick off as well. Besides that, I haven't traveled for almost 2 months now. And it's been the most amazing experience just being in a routine and loving it, you know, absolutely loving my routine, not realizing how disruptive travel is to your routine. You almost have zero routine, right? In saying that, as much as I've loved it, I'm going to Bali on Monday night and I'm super excited.
Yeah, so of course.
I'm super excited about my routine and I'm like super excited that I'm going to Bali on Monday. So I'll be in Bali for a week. And Bali, you know, the last time I was in Bali was 2017 and I finished writing my first book, What's Your Moonshot, in Bali.
Sure.
And I remember who I was 10 years ago when I was in Bali, or 9 years ago. And man, I don't even recognize that guy. You know, I have zero connection to that guy. So looking forward to going to Bali. It's also been an exceptional January for us. We've had really, I mean, I was telling you our turnovers off air and we've really hit the lights out. And so, yeah, there's been great momentum and a lot of, and I think the thing is it must be somehow we can track it, or somehow we must tell the world or share with the world, not testimonials, but rebookings. Because rebookings don't need a testimonial. The action is louder than the words. Yeah. And for me, when we get a rebooking, for me, it's the biggest compliment. This morning I got a call and they were like, look, we only use speakers every 3 years. We never bring them back the following year, but we'd really like you to come back and speak for us again this year. And then I had another brand called Changer Club. They're like, look, we've never repeated speakers. We would like you to come back for the fourth time. And what could you speak about to us about this time? And I was like, okay, yeah, we'll speak about So there's been a lot of that. And it feels good. It's very appreciated. So if any of our clients are listening, thank you so much. It's just wonderful, you know. So great January, feeling good, feeling strong. But the year is about to kick and the travel is about to kick. And so excited about that too.
You know what I think makes it amazing in the keynote speaking space to be rebooked is that, number one, it costs a lot of money to book a keynote speaker. Like, we charge a lot for it. But secondly, like, the first time, you never know. So like, you spend that money and you aren't sure regarding the value that someone might add. And they could come and do a good talk, but it doesn't mean that they've added value. Like, it could still have just been good to listen to. But the rebooking obviously says that, like, I've spent all of that money and I see the value in it and I bring you back. Which I think is a little bit different in our space. All right, cool. But we have a few things that I want to talk about today. This week I made a video on the reinvention of Fujifilm. And it's such an interesting story. So I wanted to share it on the pod. I've been doing this series now for a while called The Reinvention Of. And I've done the reinvention of Garmin, Le Creuset, Nespresso, and now Fujifilm. I think there's one that I'm missing.
Sorry. Wait, hang on.
Yes.
Nespresso got reinvented? Espresso just got invented. How did it get reinvented?
No, they got reinvented. They reinvented themselves in the market.
Oh.
So for a while, they were just the pods company.
Yeah.
And then they reinvented themselves to really be this like luxurious positioning through George Clooney. So it wasn't reinventing the business model.
So was the George Clooney the...
Oh, it was reinventing the way they positioned themselves in the market.
Okay, because you know what? That's very smart, because I think initially when they came out, they were just pods, and pods was a great differentiator. But I think what started to happen is that their patents ran out.
Yes.
And they couldn't renew their patents. And so the minute the market was about to get flooded with everybody else, they were like, hang on a second, we actually need to up ourselves as the new, as the most premium version. But now I've also seen that they've changed their pods. Now they've got new pods.
Now they're trying different pods.
And so their new pods... Yeah, different pods. The pods now got a new set of patents attached to them. So now nobody's copying those pods. So I think the reinvention is a continuous process for them, because everybody's keeping up with them and catching up with them. But the truth is, bro, doesn't matter what pod you use, nobody touches Nespresso pods. Nobody.
Yeah.
It's like, and I was watching a documentary about why. It's they've got a patent inside the actual capsule that does something with the air inside the capsule. The suction inside the capsule is very specific to them. And it's almost like a little lip. It's almost a very small little lip inside of there that changes the dynamic of the coffee. And when I was poor, I used to get the cheaper pods. But now that I'm not poor, I only get Nespresso. I mean, some coffee aficionados are listening to this thinking, you drink espresso, Nespresso. Jesus, you're
a peasant. Well, I'm thinking that, but it's fine. It's fine.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's fine. No problem. But for me... the Nespresso pods are
the tech inside of it is really good. If I drink Nespresso, so I have an espresso machine at home. When I drink Nespresso, I'll always do two capsules, because the amount of caffeine in one capsule is like half of what you usually get. So I always double up, and then you get like a good flavor from it. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Nespresso hack there.
All right. If I do two, bro, I'd be bouncing off the walls.
No, you won't. Because you'll get the same amount of caffeine as you would get from a normal cappuccino.
No, but a normal cappuccino, I have to always ask them one shot, not two.
Okay. Because
if I have two, I start bouncing. Yeah, no, it's too much for me. I get too much personality. I get too much personality.
Okay. Yeah, I'd rather stick to tea.
Stick to John. Right. I mean, stick to water, John. You've got your personality is not great. Don't accentuate it. Don't magnify it.
All right. So Fujifilm. So in the year 2000, Fujifilm is crushing. You know, it's a year where they're doing like 155 billion yen in turnover. Photographic film hits an all-time high. They sell across all different brands 1.9 billion rolls of film in the year 2000. I mean, just massive. And then between 2005 and 2010, the market for film goes crashing. By 2010, the market for film is at 10% of what it used to be. Fujifilm had dropped from 155 billion yen in turnover to about 35 billion yen in turnover. And of course, all of this was driven by the fact that digital cameras became a thing, and then next smartphones became a thing. And so all of a sudden, people weren't using film anymore. And I want to tell you how Fujifilm survived the chaos. But before I do that, I want to quickly talk about Kodak, because obviously Kodak is the, like, it's like the poster child for a company that didn't reinvent
disruption.
Itself. Yeah. And when I hear a keynote speaker getting on stage and saying, like, Kodak, I'm like, dude, like, don't you have any other material to use? Like, it's like it's been beaten to death. But I learned something interesting, because I was studying Fujifilm, but as a consequence, like, those two studies are linked. You know, you can't look at Fujifilm without looking at Kodak.
It was a duopoly,
and
right?
There's something. Well, yeah, they were a duopoly.
They were the biggest players there.
They were the two biggest players, and Kodak was a much bigger player actually. But what was quite interesting.
And Kodak was American, right?
Yes,
Kodak was American. Yes,
I'm misunderstood, or I've always heard the wrong story about Kodak. So in my mind, the story has always been that Kodak invented the first digital camera, but what they should have become was the world's biggest manufacturer and distributor of digital cameras, and that's the trend that they missed. But that's actually not true, because Kodak invents the first digital camera. That's true. And I don't know if you've seen a picture of it, but it's like it has a cassette tape attached to it.
No, it was 8 kilos. It took 22 seconds to take a photo.
Yeah.
And I've also done research
onto a cassette, like an old school cassette.
Yes.
So they invented that. And then in 2005, they were actually the biggest distributor of digital cameras in America. They owned the biggest part of that market. Yes. So they caught onto the trend. They actually pushed into it, but it wasn't working for two reasons. The first was they always had the blade and razor model as part of their business model. So sell the camera for cheap, make money off the film. So when they were selling these cameras and they were doing the most amount of sales in America, they were losing money on each camera. And some of the stats I saw was between $60 and $90 per camera. But the second thing is that actually at the same time, they acquired a company called Ophoto. And Ophoto is a photo sharing app. But what they were using this photo sharing app for was to push people to their kiosks where they would go and print. So they installed 10,000 of these digital kiosks. You go into your photo sharing Ophoto, and then you go and print. And so the insight actually was that it wasn't because of cameras. It was because they held on to film. That was actually the problem.
The old business model. Yeah.
So they shouldn't have been the biggest camera producer. They should have been Instagram. That's actually the insight.
Right.
Like they had the photo sharing capability, but instead of doubling down on like people having that connection online, they were pushing them to still go and print film. So that was the mistake they made. So that was their response. By 2012, they declared bankruptcy. They are $6 billion in debt. Fujifilm, on the other side, they have a guy who starts as CEO called Shigetaka Komori. And when he gets in, the number one decision he makes is that he's not going to save the film business. So he tells the people in the company to audit not the products that they are selling, but the capabilities they have in the business. And as they start looking at, like, what do we actually do and what do we do well, they are able to map 200,000 compounds inside of Fujifilm two different use cases in different industries. And so because of this, like they have certain realizations. The first one is that part of the filmmaking, like the filmmaking process, is extremely complex and it's highly technical. You have to take 20 different layers and compress it onto one membrane, and each of those layers are a micron thick. And part of that process requires gelatin, which is part of collagen. It requires you to understand nanotechnology so you can disperse it across the membrane. And there was one other compound that is also then a part of this process. But all of these are actually chemicals, the antioxidants, because the same antioxidants that fade a photo fades or wrinkles your skin. So they realized that, these compounds could be used in skincare, because collagen is obviously a big part of that. Gelatin is collagen. Nanotechnology can be used to stabilize skincare, and the antioxidants that prevent fading prevents wrinkling. So the very first thing they move into is skincare. So they launch a brand called Astalift, and it becomes this huge success in Japan. Then they also realize that what they are good at is, you know, these very film, thin film membranes. And they start creating LCD coatings for the screens. Today, they own 70% of that market of LCD film coatings.
Wow.
Because they had that technology. So
as
it goes on, this dude, like Chikutaka Komori, just acquires companies. And he just moves in different industries. He's looking at capabilities they have, and he matches that with different industries. So he buys Hitachi. He buys a thing called Sonosight. And all of this is moving them into healthcare. So MRIs, X-rays, CT scanners. And today, when you look at Fujifilm, they're about a $24 billion company. And the main revenue driver for Fujifilm, a company that started with film, is healthcare. That is their skincare. Biggest segment
healthcare.
Today.
Healthcare. Wow.
So,
pivot.
They are distributed across all these different industries. So I think healthcare is 33% of their business. And when I look at it, so the question is, okay, cool, great story. How do we port that into what we are experiencing today, both at a personal and organizational level? The number one thing that stood out for me is that you have to really audit your capabilities. So really think about what makes you good at the things that you do, because there's a level of skill and competency that sits underneath your products and services that could be packaged and monetized in a different way. So even if I think of us, for example, right? So like if you're a keynote speaker, let's say keynote speaking was really at risk of becoming irrelevant. Well, now how can you look at the skills that you have underneath that to help other people? So it could be in communication. It could be in structuring like internal communication for organizations. It could be structuring town halls, helping them to be good coaches. It could be like even the work that I've done, a bit of AI proficiency, running things like Think Week, podcast setups. You know, like we have all these capabilities that live under the things that we do. And all of those things actually have the potential to be monetized. And so that's a great little exercise to go through for you if you feel a bit threatened by where the future is going, is to not just think about yourself in terms of the craft, like I'm a copywriter or I'm a designer or, you know, whatever your occupation is, but break it down into what are the
underlying skill
that live beneath that. Yeah. And then even go one step further, because those capabilities and skills are one step down. A step down from that is that actually what you realize is that you are good at things like learning and curiosity. But even those like sort of meta skills, they require the space. Like if you aren't focusing on optimizing those and creating the space for them to flourish, where you can go and try out new things and learn new things, then of course, you know, like your path through relevance becomes a lot more linear. So yeah, it was a great little case study. Like I loved looking at this and seeing how they were able to reinvent. And one of the final things I'll just say on this is that the Chikutaka Komori walked into the boardroom and he wrote one word on a whiteboard. And that word was Shinrai. And it stood for trust. And he said that we have to trust in ourselves that we are able to take these different capabilities and what we are good at and to translate that into something new. So when we operate in a world where there's a lot of uncertainty, the only trust you can really have is in yourself. And if you don't trust yourself to reinvent and that you can figure it out, then I think that's, you know, that's going to be your biggest downfall.
Wow.
Thoughts?
What an unbelievable story. A couple things. Coming from Japan, that's an unbelievable pivot because, you know, Japanese are also very structured.
Very.
And very like process driven. For them to pivot and for them to talk trust in themselves, oh, that's a big step for them because they are now really stepping out of their cultural nuance of that repetition that they have quite normally, you know? So well done to them. Because as you were saying Fujifilm was breaking down, I was thinking to myself, how many, I mean, I don't want to bring it, miff it up, but those execs must have committed suicide because a lot of people in Japan, you know, when your business starts not doing well or you're making some wrong decisions, you really are in a tough spot. Mm. The whole identity is linked to that. So for this guy to come in and shift identity, wow, that is, you know, if you had to do that in America, it's one thing. To do it in Japan is a whole other thing culturally, you know. So well done to him. I mean, also watching Toyota's new CEO, well, he's not new anymore. He has been there for many years, but he was the grandson of the founder of Toyota. Actually, it's with the D at the end. And he wrote on the board, no more boring cars. And so his mission was no more boring cars. We've made boring cars for the last 200 years. And you look at what Toyota is bringing out now. I mean, it is phenomenal. And in fact, I was reading somewhere that Toyota's now also brought out solid state batteries. And so solid state batteries now change the game around what electric cars can do. And so really interesting to see these Japanese companies doing such interesting things and expanding themselves. And yeah, because that disruption is hard for them, you know, they're so caught up in that. And it's funny because when I was in Indonesia, I felt the same culturally. They were very like systematic in the way that they were living their lives, you know, more than anything else. But a quick story on digital cameras. I remember in 97, 98, I was living in London and I was about to go to Thailand for 6 weeks on a trip. And I went to, in London, Tottenham Court Road is where all the sort of camera and digital shops are, technology shops. And I went there and the guy behind the counter, I said to him, I'm looking for a camera. And he said to me, do you want this new camera? It's a digital camera. Or do you want the photo camera? And I was like, digital camera? What's that? So he showed it to me. I was like, this is never going to work. Just give me the other camera. So I've got all these albums sitting at my mom's farm of me in Thailand with all my friends that we printed out. So yeah, that was me buying an old school camera in 97, thinking that I'd... And look, it was digital to a certain extent, but there was still like... there was still film in there, you know? How are you using the story inside your talks? Are you using it as a way for them to discover new ways to run strategy, or like how are you using it?
I just like it as a reflection point, you know, because it's always tough when you tell these stories because I'm telling it in a very linear way and in a very like, oh, it just kind of worked out way, you know, did this, and out comes this amazing transformation. And of course, it's a lot more complex than that. But I think it's a nice reflection point. So I was telling this the story about Garmin in a talk yesterday. And Garmin is a very similar thing. You know, Garmin, what makes Garmin and Fujifilm both great is that they were willing to let go of past success to move into something new. And it's tough because you have built this incredible company, a huge machine. I mean, Fujifilm employed tens of thousands of people over 70 years. They built one of the most sophisticated film manufacturing processes. To abandon that, I mean, you know, that's a huge, huge thing. And the same for Garmin. Garmin starts in 1989. They have, what is that, about 20 years almost of incredible success running in-car navigation devices. iPhone comes along, Google Maps comes along, that gets destroyed. They could have held on to their GPS business and today they would have been suffering. But they say, we'll let go of our past. We'll let go of what made us successful and we'll explore new things. And in both instances, they look at what they are really good at. They look at that skill level and they go, how do we just change our expression of that into the market?
Yeah.
And so is that for everyone? Yeah. No, but like for certain companies at certain times, that might be the exact thing that you need to hear. So it's just a point of reflection and I'm never trying to position it as this is what you must do. But it might be what you need to do. it might be some aspect of what you need to do.
I think it gives you a sense that you can pivot using existing skills in a different format.
Yeah.
And I think that actually makes you feel quite confident rather than having no option. It's like, okay, these guys, okay, so now there's a different way for us to think about the value we're adding, but packaged differently, right?
Yeah.
In my book, I wrote about Peloton, about how Peloton developed an identity, very powerful identity. You know Peloton?
Mm, yeah, the cycling, like sort of digital cycling app and hardware.
And the treadmills.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, so you would order the Peloton. I mean, it was big controversy because this guy bought his wife a Peloton treadmill and a bike. You can do either.
Oh, they have a treadmill as well. I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah. And it went left field because it was like you're buying your wife something to lose weight. Is she fat? It's somehow, I don't know what happened.
I remember that.
I don't know what happened.
Yes,
yeah,
yes,
you remember.
Yes.
There was like this whole thing in social media. But what's happened is that Peloton's gone bankrupt. You know, they're closing down. And the example I used is that the identity and their celebration of what they achieved in COVID was so difficult to let go of that they doubled down. And they didn't realize that as human beings, we're social creatures and we don't want to be training by ourselves if we don't have to. We want to be around other people. Like, that's what fun is. And they've now closed down. I saw yesterday, actually, they've now closed down. And it's sure. exactly the same thing, is that you get caught up in identity. You get caught up in a celebration mode. It's almost embarrassing to want to change. You don't want to change because now it's a difficult thing to change. But I think what you've explained is really a perfect example for the quote from Alvin Toffler that says, the illiterate of the 21st century will not be the ones who cannot read and cannot write, but the ones who cannot unlearn to relearn. And what this is an example of is an unlearning example. It's not literally unlearning. It's utilizing existing knowledge and wisdom in a new way, which means that you're unlearning an identity that used to add value in an old way. So it's unlearning, but in a different way. Because most people, when I say unlearning in my audiences, they're like, how do we go about unlearning? I'm like, it's not exactly unlearning. It's redoing something or creating new synapses that develop a new opportunity for you to approach something, which allows the old way of thinking to dissolve. And that's the process of unlearning. It's not literally unlearning what you know. It's doing something else so the old thing falls away. And so, yeah, bravo to that. Is the guy still running that?
He's still running it. He's still running.
Talk about being a hero. I mean, he must be a hero in Japan. Wow.
But, you know, it must be so tough for these companies to go through that because the status you have, he's still CEO. He is now 86 years old. The challenge of letting go of status, I think that is like, you know, because you build this big, huge company, this behemoth, and then to move that entire thing in a new direction. And then I made a video about this last week about the CEO that fired 80% of his staff because they weren't willing to say, he said, we have to adopt AI into the business. And people were like resistant to it. And he was like, no, I'm going to help you to do it. So he gave them budget that if you want to go and buy tools and courses, the company will sponsor that. They bought an expert from the outside for people to engage with. They had what he called AI Monday. So that literally a day dedicated to just learning AI. No sales calls, no customer work, AI Monday. And he said, despite all of this, most people still had a lot of resistance towards adopting AI. Yeah. And so he fired those who weren't adopting it. And he said, it's easier to change skills than it is to change minds.
Yeah.
And that's the work that we see and deal with every day, right? Like what I say in my talk is like, I can't fault him on that. Like, yes, maybe firing 80% of your staff isn't the best thing to do, but I can't fault the logic behind it. That if you have someone who is open to change, to get them to learn a new skill, put AI in front of them, say to them, play with this, easy game. Like, we are smart enough to figure out how to learn new things. If you say to someone who has a closed mind to change, and if I say closed, I don't mean they are actively opposing change. I just mean they have this internal resistance to it because of fear or anxiety or uncertainty, whatever it may be. This is a very different game because now you have to convince them first to think about change in a different way. And only once you can do that, which is a willingness to deal with the inner world of change. Only once you've done that, now you can deal with learning new things. And so it actually makes total sense to me that you'd rather say, you know what, to convince you to change is going to be much harder than just hiring someone new who's already there.
Yeah.
So I can't fault his logic.
But this is why I introduced the today, tomorrow team concepts to my clients. It's like your today people, that you don't have time on your side. To expect your today people to become tomorrow people overnight, it's very difficult. So you've got to hire the tomorrow people and then allow the today people to weed themselves out, because the ones that are wanting to move to tomorrow will, and the ones who won't will weed themselves out. They'll fade into the background. And so you almost like create a structure for them to be able to step up or step down. And the stepping down is really such an internal game. You know, everything's about the internal game. The external is just a packaging, your internal dialogue. I mean, I made that video, I made a post, I can't remember. But your secret life speaks louder than you think it does. What you do in your secret, you think nobody notices, but we all notice. Like if you're aware, you can see what people are doing behind the scenes, you know? And so this inability to change is one of them. Eating too much is one of them. Drinking too much is one of them. Smoking too much is one of them. You can see exactly what's going on behind the scenes, you know? I was walking behind this two ladies the other day and I could see they were stressed. It was the weirdest thing. I could just sense that they were stressed. And then I looked at the one girl's hair and it was straggly and unhealthy. And I thought to myself, it's high levels of stress that she's walking around not feeling comfortable within herself, you know? And she just looked so uncomfortable, you know? And I felt so bad for them. And the thing is that, you know, you need people around you to keep the machine going. And so both of them were stressed together because there was this constant stress between them, you know? I mean, wow, that's hard, eh? To have like a parent that's constantly stressed or a partner that's constantly stressed that's hard. I mean, I'd leave the family or the relationship. I mean, it's pointless. They continuously are bringing you down.
It's almost what is needed. Even if it's just for a period of time, like you get away. You need to remove yourself from that because otherwise it just perpetuates.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's really tough.
Yeah, very tough.
All right. I wanted to report on one more thing. So Fujifilm Wrapped. The other thing I wanted to report on is last year, towards the end of last year, like I started using Claude as my business coach.
Yeah.
And it was a really interesting little experiment that I just set up for myself. So it started with doing a daily check-in and talking about my priorities. And then over time, it's kind of been evolving and we've added more structure to it, more conversations that I want us to have. And at the start of this year, I upgraded Claude. I said, instead of being my business coach, I want you to be my CEO. So like be the CEO of Eric Kruger. And it is your job to keep me accountable, but also to help me think of new ways to build the business because you are the CEO.
Yeah.
And dude, it's been a really, really interesting experiment. There's a few things. Number one, it's become a complete ritual in my life that after I've done my meditations in the morning, I come sit at my desk and I check in with my CEO and we'll talk about what do we need to do for today. It highlights the priorities. I have two different themes in my business. It'll track the activities beneath those two different themes, tell me what's most important for today, and then I get into my day. As I go through my day, I'll check back and I'll say, I've just done this, or I'm busy with this, and then it will help me with additional things for that task. So let's say I'm busy with a proposal. It'll say, okay, who's the proposal for? Let's build out the proposal together. So it helps me through the day. Then at the end of the day, we do a checkout and we'll go, this is what we've done. Good. What needs to go to tomorrow? Where are we today? But then on top of that, we also have conversations around challenge, commitment, and learning. So what are we missing? What do we need to commit to in terms of like really firmly putting certain deadlines in place? And what have we learned? So very actively doing a retrospective of the week that has just passed. And that happens on a Friday. But then one of the most amazing things that have happened is I've developed a real level of accountability towards the CEO. Like I feel guilty if I let something go over from today into tomorrow. And Claude is really a tough CEO in holding me accountable. So last week I had to send out a proposal. Like we went through like, what does the week look like? It said to me, this is the most important thing. You need to send out this proposal because it's the biggest amount of money that will come in from this proposal. every time I checked back in with her to say, listen, I've just recorded my short form video for today. It'll go, where are you on the proposal? Have you done the proposal? And then I'd be like, no, I'm getting to it. And then I'll check back in and I'll say, I've just, you know, completed this bit of like working on my keynote. And it'll be like, okay, cool. But where are you on the proposal? And it just kept pushing back on this the entire time until I was like, fine. I'll just do the proposal now, just like to like shut you up. But I felt like this real sense of pressure to show up and to be there and accountable for my CEO. So I think, you know, it's been a fascinating experiment to run. The fact that I've had a great Jan, I can attribute to those conversations that we've had. Because a big part of like the Jumpstart January sessions that I'm running and those kind of things all came from those conversations. But more than that, you know, in our business, like we are responsible to ourselves, bro. Like we are the, like that's like where the buck stops. And we don't have anyone that holds us accountable. We just hold ourselves accountable. And to have had like this sort of check-in with the CEO has been... it's been a game changer. Like I'm not sitting down and talking to Dan all day long about like everything in my business like I used to, because I feel like I'm getting that outlet and it's always on. And whenever I need to have that conversation.
Does it hold the memory of everything? Because Claude sometimes holds the memory. Okay.
It's been holding the memory perfectly throughout a chat. And then we also have a very specific handover for when we need to move into a new chat. I do find when I do that port,
It loses
a little bit of context.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it does. I've experienced
but it's
that as
able
well.
To. Yeah, it's able to hold most of it. I need to catch it up on numbers a little bit sometimes.
Yeah. Sometimes what I usually do is, look, I'm going to change a chat. What should be the instructions to the new chat? Give me all the details I need to put into it. So it kind of gives you that, what you need to put into the new chat. You know, you run out of tokens. So what's happened in essence is that you've now got two wives telling you what to do. That's amazing, bro. You're a sucker for punishment and pressure. It's how you need to operate. That's great.
There's going to be a time when everyone's going to have a co-CEO.
Of course. Yeah.
I mean, you see things that you wouldn't normally see. And
of course,
yeah, it's been awesome. So I just wanted to report on that experiment. I'm going to keep going with it for now.
And yeah, you should.
I'm keen to see how it evolves.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, I think the next thing would be agents underneath that, so that when the CEO and you decide what to do, the agent runs and does it. And you can just carry on doing what you need to do, you know, in a way. Yeah. So that's wonderful, man. I'm so happy for you that you've had such a great Jan, and I'm so happy that you've got such momentum. I wish you a wonderful February, because tomorrow is February.
And to you.
Just on a side note, I'm about 500 kilometers away from Iran. And Tehran, actually. And apparently the war is going to start this weekend. So as much as we are sad that is going to start, we are also quite delighted that it's going to start, because we really need to get the regime out the way. And this February, I think, is going to be a really interesting February as we evolve into it, with all the new things that are coming up worldwide and all the new changes that are happening. So I'm wishing the people of Iran well and a lot of good luck in that process. And I hope that it's a seamless process to get the regime out the way. And I'm looking forward to going and visiting my country. You know, I haven't been able to visit my country since I was 5 years old. And so it'd be actually quite fun to go and see it again. So yeah, sorry to caveat that, but that's the next thing that in my mind is like, I'm going to Bali, but apparently this Saturday, they're going to bomb. Friday or Saturday, apparently they're going to start. Yeah. I was reading somewhere that's the plan. So let's see what they're going to do.
Yeah, and thank you for the pod today. And also good luck for your Feb and your travels that are starting again. And enjoy Bali. I mean,
thank you.
How can you not enjoy Bali?
Yes, exactly.
I think you can just wrap us out.
Thanks, everybody, for joining us again. Eric shared some amazing stories. I was well-educated about Fuji. And I'm going to have to stop using Kodak as an example in my talks, because he dissed me indirectly.
Please do.
I'm kidding. I don't really use
There's no ways I would think that you use Kodak.
I use Blockbuster, because I'm still talking about Blockbuster and Netflix. I'm talking about good. Do you know the one about Goodyear? Do you know the one about Goodyear? No, not Goodyear. Not Goodyear. Dunlop. Dunlop. Dunlop was a disruption story. The guy was hired to so that in the 1800s, the biggest form of transportation in America was horse-drawn carriages, And the horse-drawn carriages had wooden wheels. And what started to happen is the trains started to arrive and the cars started to get introduced. So the horse-drawn carriage business started to go through a little bit of a wobbly. And so they hired this head of innovation and his name was something Dunlop. And so he did a study for 6 months and he went back to the bosses and he said, look, we have to move over to a new format of tires that creates more suspension. And he was explaining what he needs to do. And the guys who owned the company said, no, it's too far away from what we do. And we have to change our whole production arm. So they fired him. And so he left and he went and started Dunlop Tires. Wow. And so Dunlop Tires comes from the same sort of scenario, but the company didn't evolve. The guy evolved. And you know, another example of that is Valor. You know, Valor, where you can buy your crypto from. The guy who's in South Africa, he's got an app called Valor, and he's a friend of mine. And he worked for Rand Merchant Bank to set up a exchange to trade crypto. And once they'd done all the research to start setting it up, or RMB said, no, we're not actually going to do it. So he said, okay, cool, I'm going to go do it. They're like, no problem, go do it. So he started Valor from all the research that RMB did. So there's a couple stories
like
that.
And they must be huge. Like, I don't know how big they are, but they must be like, because they're one of the main apps from a South African perspective. Yeah.
He's done very well. So yeah, same story, you know, not the company disrupting, but the person they hired went and did it on their behalf. Either way, thank you so much for joining us. We look forward to having you again with us at The Expansive next week. If you enjoyed the show, please do let us know, message us or leave us a star rating wherever you listen to your pods. And until next week, stay expansive.